Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hello, what a gorgeous library you have here in Nashville. This is actually my first visit to Nashville, and it's been a super whirlwind day, and I'm hoping to come back. But I've had a spectacular day, but I want to thank Elise and the Nashville Public Library for the invitation to be here, and obviously Parnassus Salon and the bookstore, which I've... Ann Patchett is one of my personal heroes. I mean, not only is she just a wildly talented writer, but a lovely person and such an advocate for books and for authors. And it just, you know, this partnership is just so perfect. You know, a wonderful library and a great independent bookstore. It's like peanut butter and chocolate or champagne and strawberries. It's just sort of meant to be. So it's my pleasure to be here. And so the book just came out last week. July 28th. I know. I'm so excited. When I listen to Elise, you know, going over the details of my biography, I mean, sometimes it just seems astonishing to me that I was that girl, you know, that I have that in my past as well. It's a very, you know, Cinderella kind of story. And it was a difficult way to grow up. It definitely was. And libraries actually played a really big role in my, I don't know what to call it, trajectory, my salvation. So I spent 14 years bouncing through the California foster care system with my sisters, and by the time I got to about second or third grade, I just couldn't bear going to a new school anymore and daring to make friends that I would lose immediately. And so I began making friends with librarians, which is sensible, right? It's so sensible. And when I would go to a new school, I would meet the librarian and immediately fall in love with her. And then she would make recommendations to me. I would eat my lunch in there. I read obsessively, sometimes alphabetically, everything I could get my little paws on. And the cliche, of course, you know, it's that, what, books save our lives sometimes, right? And sometimes it's not a cliche at all. And it seemed to me at the time that I was escaping my circumstances the way we often do when we read, right? We want to disappear into some other world because we can't quite tolerate being in the world that we're in. But then later it kind of occurred to me that I was doing more than just escaping. I was actually reaching, right? I was actually transcending the world that I was in and learning all sorts of things about other worlds and characters and honing my imagination. And it seems to me now that what I was also doing is learning to be a writer, a very particular kind of reader and a very particular kind of writer and in order to do the work that I do now. But it wasn't always obvious, you know, that I was going to be a writer, even though I always wrote. I wrote poetry all through my childhood. And then when I was 19 years old, I had the audacity somehow to send a poem to Cosmopolitan magazine. I know, it's funny, right? And they used to publish poetry, Cosmopolitan. So I sent them a poem. It was quite terrible, I'm sure, but... And they took it. I know. They sent me a check for $25, and they took this poem, and I was so excited when I got that check because, of course, what it meant was that I was an author. It meant that I was an author. It was really, really exciting. It was terribly empowering, too, as we know, right? To have an identity and to have a direction and something to kind of pitch myself at. But it wasn't until years later that I kind of stumbled into my first creative writing class. I was in Michigan at this point and kind of found my home in poetry and also an incredible power in the use of language and learning how to wield and use words. I mean, words are powerful, aren't they? So I went to graduate school at the University of Michigan. I have two collections of poetry. And when I was at Michigan, and would meet other writers and tell them a little bit about my upbringing, they would always say, "You should be writing a memoir." And I would say, "You know I don't write sentences, right? I mean, I write poems, tiny little, you know, enigmatic poems." And yet the idea was really intriguing to me, and I wanted to try to see if I could do that. And so I lowered my expectations as low as they could possibly go. And I gave myself permission to fail at that book, you know, right? And then some great things happened. I was able to finish the book. I got a New York agent. Nothing's more exciting when you're a poet. It's like, what? Somebody might actually, you know, read a book that I am going to write. And I got a publisher. And I went on tour for that book. This was in 2003. And I was telling this story earlier today, too, when I did an event at the Centennial Club. My very first literary event ever was in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I drove there myself, just so geeked out, you know, thinking the whole world was going to come out and meet me now that I'd published a book like 2 days earlier. And there were five people there, three of whom I knew. It's true. And the rest of the tour kind of went like that as well, and the book didn't sell. I still love that book. I really do still love that book, and I'm so, I don't know, what is it ridiculous to say I'm proud of myself, right? A little proud of myself for having accomplished that. And then I started a novel, and I'd never written a novel before, but then again, I'd never written in sentences, so I thought, well, I'm going to try that and see how that's going to go. And I had to kind of start from scratch again, because when the memoir didn't sell, I lost my agent. My agent dropped me, and my publisher dropped me, because publishing is a business, right? So I had to start all over again. I also had little kids at this point, little kids that were very sort of demanding of my time and my attention, and it actually became really important for me to have the book, because it was a great way for me to remember I could actually think. You know how that is, right? Particularly when your kids are young and you're breastfeeding and you're just like, you feel like you're leaking intelligence, that it's just flying right out of your body, right? And they want so much from you. So I would actually, even when I was hugely pregnant with my youngest son, who's now 8 years old, waddling up to the public library to sometimes write for just 1 hour a day. It took me 5 years to write that novel, and I found another agent, and I found another publisher, and I went out on the road for that book, and this time drove 3 hours through a blizzard to Pittsburgh, and there was one person there. There was one, and it was the most lightly attended event I had ever done, and I told this story earlier today, too. This one woman, I loved her. I just loved her. And I just like, you know, we don't even have to talk about me or the book. Like, let's go get a coffee. You know, you want to go to the movies? You want to be my friend? Anyway, I certainly wasn't going to stop writing because the world wasn't paying attention. And when I meet young, aspiring writers, you know, I always tell them, they're like, how do you do it? Like, how do you get to that place? And I'm like, actually, I don't know, but I can tell you that the world is always poised to tell you no. And really the challenge is, how are you going to rise up and keep doing what you do anyway? Because you need to do it. Writers write because they have to do it. You know, I would give my kidney for any of my books and, you know, my spleen, whatever, any of my organs. and I was going to keep writing no matter what. But I did start to wonder what was missing in my work, so that it wasn't really finding an audience. And I started wondering if it was because I didn't have a big idea, but I didn't know how to find one. And I had lots of terrible ideas. I remember calling my agent on the phone and telling her, "All right, forget anything I've said. I'm writing a novel set in a tourist cave in Arizona in 1967, and the book starts with a dead Mormon girl." No, seriously. And she's like, "Oh, please don't write that book. Please don't write that book." And she told me that a lot. And then I kind of had a, she did. I had a kind of a random, completely random idea that I might write a book set in the 1920s in Paris. I don't know. What do I know about Paris? And quite by chance, I picked up Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast. We know this book, A Movable Feast. I hadn't read it. And, you know, I knew, I had been an English teacher for a long time, so I knew the old, the Papa Hemingway. You know, I taught Hemingway's stories to mostly baffled sophomores who would read and say, "What is this? What does it mean?" And I'm like, "I don't know, but it's important, so read it." And here was the side of Hemingway that I wasn't familiar with at all. So A Movable Feast was published posthumously. There were pages of this in his typewriter when he died in 1961, but it's really about the beginning of his life as a writer. When he first moved to Paris as a very young man, he was 21. He hadn't published anything. He was a whippersnapper, and he was newly married to a woman named Hadley Richardson, who I had never heard of. But as I was reading A Movable Feast, I had the most profound reaction to a quality of Hemingway's writing that all I can say, it was nostalgic and just full, dripping with regret at what he had lost when he lost her. And I just bought into that. I just bought into the love story. I was very moved by it. And I was very curious about this woman. Who was Hadley Richardson? Like, who was she? And how did she meet Ernest Hemingway? And how did they get to Paris? And Hemingway doesn't give us ever the dirt, like the goods on his own life. He's not interested in that. He has this laser-like acuity of perception, and he turns that like a white-hot spotlight on his subjects and exposes them beautifully, right? But he doesn't do that for himself, so I didn't really know how to answer these questions that I had about his life with Hadley, and so I took myself to the library, where all good things can be found, and I didn't know if there were any biographies about Hadley's life, and there were. And I found two right away. And do you ever do this trick with books where you just kind of let a book fall open and see what it has to teach you, right? I think there's actually a word for it, a kind of fortune telling that way, right? There we go. So the book fell open, and the first thing I read was just a small excerpt of a letter that Hadley wrote to a friend in 1920, not long after she met Ernest Hemingway at a party in Chicago. And again, I just had this profound reaction to Hadley's voice, and there was something about the quality of her voice. I mean, you ever meet somebody who writes a really good letter, right? We don't write letters anymore, God help us. We tweet and do all sorts of things with our phones. But when you meet a person who writes a really good letter and you read it, it's almost as if they're in the room with you. You can actually hear their voice, right? And that's the way it was with Hadley. Her humor, her intelligence, her vivacity, her particular thing, her essence, to me, felt available in her voice. And I just became obsessed with learning about her life. And I called my agent, same agent who told me not to write about the dead Mormon girl. And I said, forget everything I've told you. I'm writing a novel about Ernest Hemingway's first marriage in Paris, and there's going to be sex and bullfighting and absinthe and a ménage à trois on the French Riviera. And she's like, sister, you are writing that book. Write as fast as you can. And that's what I did. I had three teaching jobs at the time, you know, and still was making sort of like below minimum wage. Oh my God. And I quit my job, and my husband and I borrowed money from his parents. And I wrote in a Starbucks near my house in Cleveland. And I wrote like I was on fire. And in about 7 months, I had a draft. And every day, oh my God, it was so fun. I would drop my kids at the bus, and I'd throw all my research books into a bag, and I'd schlep into the Starbucks and sit in the same chair every day. I couldn't afford my own office, but I didn't really need my own office, because for $1.85, which is what it costs for a tall, dark roast coffee. I could sit there all day, and that's what I did every day for 7 months, and then I had a book. And it was so exciting to have that book. And yet, I was terrified. I was terrified the same thing would happen, and I already loved that book more than, I mean, it was safe. It was not safe to love the book as much as I did. And I remember going out onto the road with that book, just being petrified. And I went out on tour just about the same time as I am here. You know, no one had read it. I didn't want to go out. And I had a terrible respiratory infection. I had a 102-degree fever. And I was going to St. Louis, and it was raining cats and dogs. And I felt colossally sorry for myself, just so sorry for myself that I had to go out and do this event. And no one was going to be there. And I arrived at the store, and it was standing room only. And all the good people of St. Louis had come out. And I decided on the spot that I was going to read an excerpt from the book that is set in St. Louis, because St. Louis is Hadley's hometown. So I read a section from The Paris Wife where she goes to the World's Fair with her sister Fawny, and they walk on the pike, and they have ice cream, and she talks about her father's suicide and her relationship with her mother. And when I finished the excerpt from the book, and the Q&A started, this octogenarian gentleman stood up in the front row, and he said, "That was just beautiful. Aunt Hadley would have loved it." Exactly. And it was her nephew, her sister Fawny's son, and 9 members of the family had come out to my event. And it never occurred to me that that might happen. But it never occurred to me that anyone would be there, right? But here's the thing about writing fiction about people who actually lived. People who knew them can come in and talk to you, and you can go to places where they lived. And I actually have never done any event where somebody hasn't come forward and said something like, "I knew Hemingway back when, you know, his wife Mary broke her arm and they came into the hospital and he was lovely," or "I was in, you know, Rochester, Minnesota when Hemingway was having electric shock therapy, and every day he would walk across the street and have a ham salad sandwich and a near beer," you know. But nothing as special as this moment ever happened to me again, when there was her nephew saying, you know, "Aunt Hadley taught me how to dance, and she was the most remarkable woman, and now the whole world will know her." And it felt like an incredible benediction. Do you know what I mean? Like, he gave me his blessing, and it also occurred to me, really for the first time, what I had done by taking her up as a subject, because the whole thing was such a fluke. Like I've ever thought I was going to write a historical novel. It was an accident. It was the most marvelous accident that she found me. But then it started to occur to me, as I said, that, you know, taking her up as a subject, it was a sort of an incredible responsibility and also a privilege. And that, you know, Hemingway was this huge figure, and he eclipsed her life. Hemingway had 4 wives, and she was just the first one. The early wife, the Paris wife, that ditzy broad who lost the manuscripts on the train. And what I got to do was sort of drag her out of the shadows. You know, in The Sun Also Rises, which Hemingway was writing, only because he had this wife who did, you know, who supported him unequivocally, who was his best friend, his muse, the mother of his child, but mostly like a bastion of support for him. I think that's pretty profound, that he was able to pursue his genius because he had the support of this amazing woman. Anyway, so everyone he knew at that time, he was writing The Sun Also Rises, ends up in that book, except for Hadley. And how delicious that was for me to put her right back in, right back where she belongs, and to tell that story of that time period and all of it, all of that time period from her point of view. It was very exciting for me. And like I said, important and kind of an intimate act to kind of reach through time and space and connect to this remarkable woman. I fell madly in love with all of them. Okay, maybe not Pauline, but I did, and Hemingway too. God bless him, the dirty rat. Hemingway too. And when it came time for me to write another book, I knew I was going to write historical fiction. In fact, I continue, I hope, to be writing it until I'm dead, and maybe after that, if they let me. But I had a really difficult time finding another subject. And in fact, it was like torture. It was like torture. And part of it was that I intimidated myself, right? Because something special, something like magic happened when I found Hadley as a subject. And I had never been to Paris, let alone Paris in 1922. I had never written historical fiction. I had never done research for a book. But each piece of it was so inspiring to me. I was inspired. I was swept away. I was transported. I often say that writing that book was like being strapped to the side of a rocket ship, and that ship was just going to go. And all I had to do was like hold on and not screw it up. The story was so good. I just had to get out of the way. How was I going to find something like that? How was I going to find a subject that would move me as much and that I would fall in love with as much? And I just didn't. I mean, it was years. It was years. I had lots of ideas. I wrote hundreds of pages. I freaked my agent out, thinking I was having a nervous breakdown. And then I started writing a novel about Marie Curie and had a contract for a novel about Marie Curie. I wrote 15 pages and sold a book to Random House to write a novel about Marie Curie. And I was very excited. I'm like, okay, finally, I'm there. I have it. I have my subject. She's incredible. Like, who's more inspiring than Marie Curie? It's going to be great. I get to go back to Paris in 1894. There's Pierre. He dies tragically, so that's good. Check. There's no sex, but there's radium. Check. And I started to do all this research, and I think I could be a physicist in 1894. I mean, I just read everything till my eyes bled, and I did all the travel, and I wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages, three different drafts, and all of it was terrible. It was terrible. And I'm not just saying that. No, my editor, God bless her, she just kept saying things like, it's just so boring. Like, the science is boring. And Marie, she's like, she wears these heavy shoes. And she is in her laboratory, like, stirring the pitch blend with an iron bar. And the iron bar is like Marie, you know? But it wasn't her. It wasn't Marie's fault that she was boring. Something had failed. I had failed to find her. I couldn't find her voice. I couldn't get the point of view. I couldn't get the arc of the story. The love angle was missing, and I just didn't believe any of it myself. And I wasn't in it, and it wasn't alive. But I don't know what makes something alive. It's almost like I couldn't fix it. It was broken from the inside out, and I didn't know how to fix it, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And around the same time, I went on vacation with my sisters and my brother-in-law in Orlando, Florida. And my brother-in-law is a doctor, but he's also a pilot, and he was reading a book by the pool. And that book was West with the Night by Beryl Markham. And I had never heard of it. And he kept looking up at me and saying, oh, my God, this is amazing. This is amazing, and this woman is phenomenal, and you need to know this book. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, whatever. Give me the margarita. And I ignored him because people tell me every day what I should be writing about. People come to me at events. I've had people come up to me in Target and tell me what they think I should be writing about. This is my brother-in-law. Yeah, whatever. So go away. And thank goodness he ignored me right back, and he shoved the book in my hands, and he's like, you are going to read this book, and you're going to write about this woman. And I took the book home, and I'm so stubborn, and I put it in my dining room where it sat for a year and a half while I was beating my head against the same wall that I had been doing. And then one day, sort of, you know, at the edge of reason, I picked up the book, I let it fall open, and so actually toward the middle of the book where Beryl is writing about her African childhood, and I had, it was like being struck by lightning. I mean, it was not a subtle moment. All the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, and I was just completely, completely mesmerized by something. I don't know. Some quality in her voice, something about the world, just hooked me instantly. And I knew nothing about Beryl's life, only that I was going to write about her. And that was it. And I started writing that day, even before I knew anything about her. So, West with the Night, who's read West with the Night? Oh, yay! Go Beryl! Go Team Beryl! Well, I didn't know about her. And so when I started reading, that was my number one question. You know, so Beryl was the first woman to fly the Atlantic solo from east to west in 1936. So she's a contemporary of Amelia Earhart's. We all know Amelia Earhart, right? Her life glows like she's America's sweetheart. Who hasn't heard of her? Why didn't I know who Beryl Markham was? So that was one question I had. And I started reading the book. And you know, if you've read West with the Night, you know that Beryl was such an unconventional woman. I mean, really one of the boldest, most singular women who have ever lived. So she learned to fly at a time when women didn't really do that. She was also the first licensed female racehorse trainer in the world when she was 18 years old. She was one of the first women in the world to have a commercials pilot's license. She was one of the first people, in fact, she was. She pioneered the act of, she was a bush pilot in Africa, of spotting big game from the air for safari hunters, which was incredibly dangerous work to do. And she just took everything on with kind of a fearlessness and a ferocity. And I just thought, this girl, she's like, there, she takes no prisoners. Like, how does the world make somebody like Beryl Markham? And then I started reading biography, and was really struck by just how much of Beryl's life is invisible in her memoir. West with the Night is fabulous. It is not an autobiography. It is nothing like that. Beryl, just as much as Ernest Hemingway does, hides all of the good, all the stuff, the goo, the dirt, the skeletons. It's all hidden away. But it was fascinating to me. So if you don't know Beryl's story, when she was 2 years old, she's British. Her father moved, who was a horse trainer, moved their family from England to colonial Kenya, which wasn't even Kenya yet. It was the British East African Protectorate, and this was 1904, and bought 1,500 acres of untouched bush. And for a shilling an acre, this was what was happening in those days, in those pioneer days at the African frontier, and sort of moved the whole family there and started a horse farm. And 2 years after that, when Beryl was 4 years old, her mother picked up one day with her brother Dickie and went back to England. And Beryl didn't see her for 16 years. She just sort of took off. And Beryl was, I see it as sort of forced to reinvent herself as this young warrior in training with the Kipsigis tribe on her father's land. And she became a very particular kind of girl who, as I see it, because I'm obviously a pop psychologist, I think I have a degree. I think I've earned a degree at this point in pop psychology, was compelled to test herself against the thorny edges of her world, and to challenge herself and to confront those things that she was most afraid of. And so what looks like fearlessness is actually something a little more profound. She was very driven. She's very interesting to me. But I think my connection to her is so specific. I can't imagine that another writer would read West with the Night and then read biography about Beryl and have the same reaction that I did. Because Beryl's mother left her when she was 4 years old, and my mother left me when I was 4 years old. And my mother came back 16 years later, and Beryl's mother came back 16 years later. And people, you can not make that up. You know, it was... And then I learned that she knew Hemingway, right? She met Hemingway when he was on safari with his second wife, Pauline, in 1934. And when West with the Night was published, first published in 1942, Hemingway wrote a letter to Max Perkins, his editor, saying, "Have you read this book by Beryl Markham? It's bloody wonderful, and she can write rings around the rest of us." And then that book, West with the Night, even though many people thought it was a fine, fine book critically, it just disappeared in the wake of the Second World War, as many books did. It disappeared until the 1980s when Hemingway's son, John, Bumby, my Bumby, is living in L.A., and he's showing some of his father's letters to a friend of his. And in that stack was this letter to Max Perkins. "Have you read Beryl Markham's book? It's bloody wonderful." And the friend said, "Who's Beryl Markham? Like, I don't know this book." And the book was out of print, and he searched it out, and he found it and fell madly in love with it, and wrote to Beryl, who was living in Nairobi in her 80s in poverty, and said, "I'm in love with your book, and I'm going to reprint it." And he did, and it was a bestseller. And inadvertently, she has Hemingway to thank. And again, like, it was just so striking to me that this book essentially, like, smacked me, you know, like a crosstown bus. It's like such a fluke, and yet it feels like fate. How could it not be fate that I would write about this woman? So I started writing the book. I wrote the book in 5 months, which is the fastest I've ever written anything. Maybe part of it was because I'd been stuck in the laboratory with poor Marie, stirring the pitch blend. I was so primed to go to Africa. Are you kidding me? It was delicious. It was like being in a Thelma and Louise movie. I was riding shotgun with Beryl Markham, and it was absolutely amazing. And when I finished the book, I was able to travel to Kenya. The coolest thing, hands down, the coolest thing I have ever done. And, you know, she died in Nairobi in 1986, but I also just had the feeling when I was there that she was still there. And again, there's this amazing thing about writing fiction about people who actually lived. You can go into the world and meet people who knew them and to go places that meant something to them, and to go to Nairobi, which is so different from the Nairobi. When Beryl, you know, moved there, it was tin shacks and goats, right? Eucalyptus trees and red dust and nothing. And now it's a city of 4 million people. But you can go to the Mutega Club. Have you guys seen Out of Africa? Ugh. You can go to the Mutega Club, which hasn't changed, essentially, since 1913. You can go to the Norfolk Hotel, where Beryl, you know, was married when she was 17 years old. You can go to the racetrack where she ran her beloved horses, and to the aerodrome where she learned to fly in 1929. The farm that her father bought in Njoro, which is 100 miles up country from Nairobi, is still a horse farm. And I stayed in the cottage that Beryl's father built for her when she was 14. Because it's like a guest house. And you guys could all go there, and I think you should, and stay in Beryl's cottage. And I went up in a vintage open-air biplane, like that scene from Out of Africa, right? That scene from Out of Africa where Meryl Streep reaches back and touches Dennis Finchatten's hand. And that's something I haven't said yet tonight, which is something I learned when I was researching Beryl's life. Another essential detail that she leaves out of West with the Night is the fact that she was, for 10 years, involved in a juicy, complicated love triangle with Karen Blixen, who wrote Out of Africa under the pen name Isak Dinsen, and Dennis Finchatten, the safari hunter. I like to call him in my dreams Robert Redford. And many times that man has washed my hair along a riverbank in my fantasies. Oh my God, I love that movie so much, and I love that love story. But even more, I loved learning that it was more complicated than that. And there was a whole story there in the same way that Hadley was written out of The Sun Also Rises, Beryl has been written out of Africa, and I have the privilege to put her right back in where she was, where she belongs, and it's fabulous, and it has been completely fabulous. So I'm just going to finish by reading for 5 minutes from the new book, and this is a scene when Beryl is 10 years old, and it's also an experience that she writes about in West with the Night, so perhaps some of you will recognize it. So this is Beryl. The day we rode out to Kabete Station to visit my father's friend Jim Elkington on his ranch at the edge of the Kikuyu Reserve, my father's mind was on lions. A lion has more natural intelligence than most men, he said, pushing his bush hat back off his forehead with a fingertip. He wore khakis for riding, a light cotton shirt, pants the color of sand, and boots that would have had a high polish in the English countryside, but here were rinsed with layers of red silt. He also has more courage than a man and more determination. He'll fight for what belongs to him, no matter the size or strength of his rival, and if the rival has a drop of cowardice, he's dead already. I wanted my father to go on talking all the way to the Elkington's farm and even further. If I just listened hard enough, I thought, I might someday know everything he did. What if two equal lions battle for territory or a mate? They'll size each other up, testing the odds. A lion is more cautious on equal footing, but even then he won't back down. He has no fear, you see, not as we understand it. He can only be exactly what he is, what his nature dictates, and nothing else. I wonder if this can be true of the Elkington's lion, said Bishan Singh, our Sikh groom. He had journeyed with us to care for our horses and rode just behind my father. That damned animal makes me nervous, my father answered. I don't mind telling you. It's unnatural for a wild creature to be kept like that. I like Paddy, I said, remembering how I had once seen Jim Elkington rub him like a cat. He's a good lion. Which only proves my point, my father said, while behind us Bishan Singh clucked his agreement. You can take a cub from the savannah, like they have, and raise it like a pet if you like, in a cage, as some do, or running free, like Paddy. You can feed it fresh meat so it never learns to hunt, and brush its coat so it carries a human smell wherever it goes, but know that what you've done is twist something natural into something else, and you can never trust an unnatural thing. You don't know what it is, and it's baffled too. Poor damned animal, he said again, and blew air up toward his nose to clear away some of the dust. The Elkington's house had lead glass windows and a pretty veranda that backed onto absolute wilderness, 1,000 miles or more of untamed Africa. And there was a feeling as you sat and ate your nice sandwiches and had your tea that you were on the slowly tipping edge of nothingness and might fall forward at any moment, and that if you did, it was possible that nothing would know you had ever been there at all. Jim Elkington was round and red-faced and even-tempered. His wife wore a straw boater and white blouses. She kept crisp and civilized-looking somehow, even with a rawhide whip tucked into her belt. The whip was for Paddy, who roamed the property as if he owned the place, and in the clearest sort of way, he did. Who would challenge him, after all? He had been like a puppy once, thick pawed, wrestling Jim on the lawn, but now he was full grown, his ruff of mane black tipped and glossy. The whip was only a prop. The last time I had seen Paddy, Jim Elkington had fed him a string of skinned rabbits on a pike as we watched. The lion rested with his paws crossed, full shouldered and rust colored, with black lips and jowls. He had enormous golden eyes and seemed aware of the picture he made as he let the dainties come to him. There was a wrinkled place above his perfectly square nose, which made him look puzzled or even a little amused by us. As we settled our horses, I didn't see Paddy, but I could hear him off somewhere, maybe miles away, roaring. It was a tortured sound and also a little mournful, stiffening the fine hairs on the back of my neck. "He sounds lonely," I said. "Rot," my father said, "more like a howling banshee." "I don't hear it anymore," Mrs. Elkington said, and then led us to her tea, small, nice-smelling ginger cakes, dried fruit, potato dumplings in crisped skins that were eaten with your fingers, and good China tea in a pot. Jim had made a pitcher of cocktails with rye whiskey and crushed lemons. He stirred the pitcher with a glass rod, rare ice tinkling like crystal teardrops. The veranda was airless that day and the conversation stultifying. I sighed and picked at a second ginger cake until my father finally gave me a look and a nod. "Go on, then." And he and Jim rose to head toward the stables. Mrs. Elkington tried to ply me with a dice game, but I made off as quickly as I could, flinging my shoes and stockings into the grass and hurrying across the long yard. I headed out into open country, running fast just to feel myself do it. Their land was much like ours, with dry grasses, dusty green and gold, and the rolling plain studded with thorn and flame, or sometimes a single fat baobab tree. Away in the distance, I could see the cloud-softened crags of Mount Kenya and thought of how wonderful it would be to run there hundreds of miles away. Ahead of me, there was a low hill with gooseberry bushes on top. I made a beeline for them, only half noticing a place in the grass where something large had slept recently, crushing the stems all around into a curved, pressed-down mold. I had my eyes on the hill and didn't think of anything else or know that I was being watched as I ran, stalked from behind like a young gazelle or Kangani. I picked up speed, scrambling over the rise, and that's when I felt a force of air push at me, hot and meaty. The blow was like a steel pipe aimed at the muscles of my back. I went down hard, face first in the grass, my arms coming up instinctively to block my face. I didn't know how long Paddy had been watching me. He had smelled me first, probably before I left the veranda. Maybe he had only been curious about my girl smell, or maybe he had started hunting me even then. It didn't really matter because he had already overpowered me. Paddy's jaw closed on my thigh above the knee. I felt his dagger teeth and his wet tongue, the strangely cool feel of his mouth. My head swam as I smelled my own blood, and then he loosed me to bellow. It was everything I had heard from the veranda and more, a vibrating black cave of noise that swallowed the earth and the sky, and it swallowed me too. I closed my eyes and I tried to scream, but only released a puff of air. I felt Paddy's mouth again, and I knew I had no chance at all. He would either eat me here or drag me off to a glade or a valley only he knew of, a place from where I would never return. And the last thought I remember having was, "This is how it feels then. This is what it means to be eaten by a lion." Thank you. What happens next to Beryl? We have to find out. Anyway, I'm happy to take questions now if you have questions. How do you know all of this stuff about my Beryl? Your grandmother. See what I'm saying, people? Her grandmother knows Beryl. Did you hear the question? That Beryl very probably conceived a child that was Dennis Finch Hatton's child. You know, he was a very independent person. That's in the movie. You see this, his struggles with Karen, that he wasn't really for the having. He was an independent spirit, and he wasn't really for the having. Beryl was in love with him for, as I said, about a decade. And at one point, she very probably became pregnant with his child, and the speculation is that she went to England and discovered she was pregnant there and probably terminated the pregnancy. And that is the storyline in my novel. Incredibly difficult story. And Beryl has lots of difficult decisions, and there's a lot of sadness and loss in her story. Yeah, but that's probably what happened. Are you a writer? Did you hear the question? So she's sort of asking about writing a novel and that it's so many words. I mean, a novel is somewhere around between 85,000 and 120,000 words, or as an average, 100,000 words. And you bet I count my words. I count my words every day. I'm a hoarder. And you know what? Ernest Hemingway counted his words every single day, too. And he kept it on little, you know, pieces of paper, and that's what I do, is I write my word count down every day, like a lunatic. And the reason I do it is because I need to know I'm getting somewhere. I'm getting somewhere. At a certain point, it starts to feel like a book, somewhere around 20,000 words, actually. And then I print out the pages. It's completely unnecessary because it's not anything yet, because I need to feel that the pages have weight and that it's a thing and I'm actually doing something. I know.
Do you ever worry that you're not going to have enough words?
All the time. Yeah, that all the other writers have stolen them. The writer Charlie Baxter is a wonderful novelist and story writer, has a very funny essay about the difference between poets and fiction writers. You know, there are the fiction writers at parties hoarding their words, and there are the poets like writing, scrawling things on the backs of pizza boxes and saying, "Done, I'm done. It's my work for the day." It's sort of like that. Yes, ma'am.
I'd be curious to know, did any other research besides reading West of the Night and what that process was?
Mm-hmm. Research is really interesting to me, and the balance between research and sort of, you know, scrutinizing and sifting through the historical facts on record, and then the imagination, because it's somewhere between. This is still a novel, right? I like to sort of start writing while I'm still desperately obsessed with finding. You know, I started writing this book and the Paris Wife too before I really knew the end of Hadley's story. I wanted to be kind of swept away by it and sort of borne up in the machinery of the story. And there's an urgency that's created when you do that. And a kind of writing in the dark. I believe our subconscious knows all sorts of things that we don't know and makes profound connections that we can't know. And that sometimes our rational minds have to be left out of the party. I do believe that. But I would get to places that I would need to know something. I would need to know sort of what the controls were in her particular plane, you know. I need to know about racehorse training in Nairobi in 1922. I needed to know about the parts of the animal. You know, I grew up with horses in the Central Valley in California, but I was like a cowgirl. You know, I was like Annie Oakley riding barefoot and like bareback, right? I needed to know what someone who was an expert would say about the pieces and parts of animals and about the actual races. So each time I would come to some moment that I would need to know something about, then I would research that. Karen's husband, Bror Blixen, was a safari hunter and has a memoir called African Hunter, which is just completely fabulous. And I love him, Bror, as a character. You know, I needed to explore what the peerage was. You know, what does it mean when somebody is the honorable Barclay Cole? You know, who was Lord Delamere and who was he married to, and what's the lineage here, and what is the landscape like? And I mean, it was really fascinating putting it all together, and I read everything I could possibly read about colonial Africa. Elspeth Huxley has that amazing book, The Flame Trees of Theca. I have a beautiful illustrated copy. I needed to know more about those crazy Happy Valley people, so I read Frances Osborne's The Bolter. Do you guys know that book? So yummy. It's really fun. And it's fun to build a book like that. You know, it's like a puzzle or like making a quilt, and each little piece has to work in order for the whole, because you're building a whole world and filling it full of people who say things to one another, and they have to sound like they know what they're talking about. It's their world, after all. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
This is one of the most stunning covers that I've ever seen.
Isn't it lovely?
Quality book, too. It's absolutely beautiful. Can you tell us a little bit about the development of the design on the cover?
I'm so madly in love with this cover. Oh, my God. Yes, and the book glows. I've been passing it in airports. It's just so beautiful. And it stops me. It's a head-turner. It is a head-turner at the Hudson's. Yeah, it's... So this woman looks a lot like Beryl Markham. So Beryl Markham, she was like almost 6 feet tall. She looked like Greta Garbo. She had really good hair, just like this woman. So this woman is a photographer and a model, and she lives in New York, and I actually don't know how Random House found the model. But the first time I saw a cover, a mock-up cover of the book, it was this gorgeous woman, and it was a blue background, and she was just looking off into nothingness, you know, stunning. But it didn't tell a story. And we thought that it needed to tell a story. So then my editor found a still from Out of Africa where Meryl Streep is sitting in a chair. She's returned from work and she's wearing these riding clothes and she's got dusty boots and she's having a drink and she's looking off, you know, into whatever and thinking her deep thoughts. And we're like, that's it. And so we told the woman what to wear. And my editor went online and found this rattan chair, right? And they're like, she needs to be drinking scotch because she's a badass and she would drink the scotch. And I love this cover. I think it's the most delicious thing. I want to be wearing those boots. I want to be thinking her thoughts, and I want the really good hair. When I went over to Kenya, I met her. So Beryl's second husband is Mansfield Markham. And some of his family members are still in Kenya. A lot of sort of the pioneers have descendants that are still in colonial Kenya. And I had lunch with Mansfield's godson. And I was just waiting for the nasty stories because, of course, Mansfield's family didn't like Beryl. And he actually told me he was madly in love with her when he was 19. It's like everybody was madly in love with Beryl. She was that kind of girl. You couldn't help it. You couldn't help it. She just magnetized, particularly men. And so there was no cover yet. There was just an image on my iPhone that they had sent me, and I couldn't help but show it to him. And he's like, oh, my goodness, I've never seen that picture of Beryl. Where did you find it? And then I knew he really had a winner. Yeah, it's really, it's lovely.
It's time for one more.
One more.
Her mother and brother left and came back.
I'm so sorry. I just don't want to leave this poor woman hanging. Yes, can I?
My question goes back to West with the Night.
Yes.
And I read the book back in the... It was published in the 80s, wasn't it?
In 84.
All right. I read it probably in the 90s, and I was just captivated with it. And I'm so excited about your book, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
And as I was reading different things about it, you know, you go on the internet and you search... And they were talking about Beryl and the fact that she had come back to the United States after after she had flown. And someone had said, you need to write a memoir.
Yes.
Which she did. And she stayed in the States for maybe 10 years and wrote the book. Then she went back to Africa. And lived there the rest of her life. Questions were raised as to whether she could have had a ghostwriter that helped her with that book because she had never written anything else.
I've heard that rumor. I've sort of heard all the rumors now. And all those rumors are still alive and well in Nairobi. They are still talking about Beryl. And that's when you know that you have an interesting woman, right? Because the questions are still lingering. Scandal and gossip and speculation followed Beryl for all of her life and even into her death. She was... a complicated woman. She made people uncomfortable because she wouldn't follow the rules. She wouldn't follow the rules, and she wouldn't play nice, and she wouldn't be curbed by the conventions of her gender. She was also famously tight-lipped. She wouldn't respond to gossip. She wouldn't respond to gossip. So I've read the rumors too. So Beryl wrote a memoir, not because she had literary ambitions. She wrote a memoir because she was broke her whole life, and somebody suggested that she might be able to make some money from it. So she's like, okay. So she started working on that book, and she'd actually delivered 16 chapters of West with the Night to her publisher before she met her third husband, Raoul Schumacher, who was a third-rate Hollywood ghostwriter. No one's actually been able to find much of anything that Raoul has written. There are a few stories, and the style is very different than Beryl's style. It's probable that he edited some of the book, but he did not write it. And in fact, it just kind of ticks me off. It ticks me off that anyone would suggest that she didn't write this book, because it's a phenomenal accomplishment. And the fact that she would have this accomplishment kind of stolen from her, because we have these other questions about her, because we're much more concerned with who she did or did not sleep with in 1936. You know what I mean? I mean, in a way, it doesn't matter. She was an extraordinary woman, and she did all these extraordinary things, and I think we should try to hold on to that. Gossip. I just can't imagine that she wasn't devastated when those rumors started sort of circling even then. But I love that, you know, that the question is being raised again, and that her life is being taken up again and given a second look, because it definitely deserves that. Okay, anyway, thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you.